Shall we go ahead?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. By way of explanation to start out, I'd like to mention that 1235, all of our 2336 and 2335 are the result of the advisory committee created by the Law Improvement Committee. And the members of that advisory committee were Thomas Scanlon, representing the labor, William Love, insurance companies, Ken Tran, the title insurance companies, J. Clark Bullock, contractors, Ralph J. Shepard, representing the Automobile Dealers Association, Ted Hyde, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Herbert Lombard, Lumberman's Industry Representative, Clara W. Woodward, representing the Oregon Building Congress, Emerson Hamilton, representing the Electric Contractors, and William Alexander, representing the suppliers, Nathan Heath from the Law Improvement Committee and myself, the Law Improvement Committee. Now, as you know, the Law Improvement Committee is one of the few statutory committees that we have in the state. And we met monthly for approximately 3 years in promulgating these two bills. And most of the time, of course, was spent on 2336. As you know, this committee is a product of the Law Improvement Committee, and the Law Improvement Committee appoints advisory committee, and that's where we picked up the probate law revision, the insurance code, the lumber code. Now I think the savings loan is about to be introduced this session, if it passed, maybe, and the evidence, which is still being worked on. We have the privilege of, as you know, of paying our own way. All these meetings, our own hotel, motel, travel. Now, statutory lien law is pretty largely confined to Chapter 87 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And covers 25 different categories, or about 25 different categories. Mechanics and materialmen, possessory lien for labor and material expended on a chattel, non-possessory lien for labor and material expended on a chattel, liens for loggers and woodworkers, mining labor and material liens, lien for fishermen and fish workers, lien for labor and material furnished for railroad contractors, lien for preparing land for cultivation and construction, farm labor, service, livestock, or materials when lien, adjuster's lien, sheep herder's lien, nurseryman's lien, attorney's lien, possessory lien for a person who transports and stores personal property, innkeeper's lien, landlord lien, hospital lien, veteran's hospital lien, stable keeper's lien, lien for stud or artificial insemination or services, timber owner's lien, agriculture products lien, irrigation power lien, uniform federal tax lien and registration act, and lien for employees and benefit plan. Now, the committee did most of its work, as I said, on the so-called mechanics lien or construction lien law, and we decided on a policy of trying to conform the other, most of those others lien in one bill, which was done. I had some considerable doubt about it, but through the good work of Mr. Barkowski and Mr. Bill Love, those statutes were pretty well conformed into 2335. Mr. Barkowski is going to lead off on 1230. First, let me see how many members of our committee do we have here. There's Emerson Hamilton and Tom Scanlon. I guess that's all that are here today. All right, go ahead, Bill.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Barkowski. I work with the Advisory Committee on Lien Law Revision and drafting both House Bills 2335 and 36. And I'm prepared now to briefly go through the bills, indicating what's contained, what changes are worked in various parts and sections of the bill, if that's agreeable.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. I'll start with House Bill 2335. This bill works a general revision of the liens contained in ORS Chapter 87, with the exceptions of the mechanics and material mix lien, which is dealt with in 2336, the hospital lien, the Uniform Federal Tax Lien Registration Act, and the lien for contributions to an employee benefit plan. Those last three liens have been left intact. House Bill 2335 reorganizes, simplifies, and clarifies the lien statutes contained in ORS Chapter 87 without making extensive substantive changes in lien concepts or priorities. The bill is divided into five parts. Part 1, General Provisions, contains basic definitions applicable to the entire statute. A second section in that part establishes priorities among the possessory and non-possessory chattel liens contained in ORS Chapter 87, and the chattel liens found elsewhere in ORS and other security interests and encumbrances. One of the problems with the lien laws, of course, is that they were written at different times. Each one says it has priority over all other liens, so you have a number of liens all claiming first priority. Section 2 of 2335 is an attempt to deal with that. The bill divides the ORS Chapter 87 liens, the current liens, into three categories: possessory chattel liens, non-possessory chattel liens, and liens on real property. Parts 2 to 5 each contain the liens found in one of those categories, and the common basic procedures for claiming a lien, notifying the lien debtor and other appropriate persons, foreclosing the lien, and regulating disposition of the proceeds of the foreclosure sale if one occurs. Part 5, Miscellaneous Provisions, contains a section amending ORS 87910 to allow a lien claimant to add $10 to his claim for the preparation of a lien notice, plus the amount of fees actually paid for recording or filing the lien notice. Under existing ORS 87910, a lien claimant is allowed to add only $5 for all these purposes. And Part 5 also contains amendments to the agricultural produce lien and a revision of the attorney's lien. I might at this point state that the amendments in 2335 to the agricultural produce lien were not added by the Advisory Committee on Lien Law Revision. They were the work of the House Judiciary Committee. The agricultural produce lien was passed in 1973, and the Advisory Committee felt that since it was such a recent lien and it did not need revision, we didn't consider the matter. The House Judiciary did add those amendments. And the Advisory Committee, I believe, takes no position either for or against those amendments. The possessory chattel liens, sections part two of the Act, sections 3 to 16, contains the following liens: the possessory lien for labor and material expended on the chattel, the cleaner's and launderer's lien, the adjuster's lien possessory, the possessory lien of a person who transports or stores personal property, the innkeeper's lien, the landlord's lien, the veterinary hospital lien, and the stablekeeper's lien. And except for the innkeeper's and landlord's lien, section 3 of the bill combines all those liens into one general possessory chattel lien. Section 4 restates the innkeeper's lien. Section 5 restates the landlord's lien. Section 6 establishes a uniform time of attachment for possessory chattel liens. An exception is made to maintain the unique attachment date for the landlord's lien. Section 7 requires persons claiming a possessory chattel lien to retain the chattel for at least 60 days before foreclosing the lien. If the chattel subject to the lien is an animal, this period is reduced to 30 days. The various liens now in Chapter 87 have various time periods before in which the chattel must be retained before foreclosure can occur. Section 8 prohibits a lien claimant from charging storage fees for a period of more than 6 months, and this section applies only if the lien is not one for storage. Section 9 maintains the existing law by allowing foreclosure by suit or foreclosure by sale. Section 10 is a section establishing notice requirements for foreclosure by sale. The lien claimant must notify both the lien debtor and the public of the sale at least 10 days prior to the sale. If the value of the chattel to be sold is $1,000 or more, then a newspaper notice by publishing in the newspaper has to occur. Section 11 requires the foreclosure sale to be in the county in which the lien claimant obtained possession of the chattel from the lien debtor. Once again, the various liens now have different, either don't mention that or have different counties specified in which the sale can occur. But the advisory committee picked the county in which the lien claimant obtained possession because this was where the lien debtor would probably, both the parties would be most familiar with this particular county. Section 12 regulates the application of the proceeds of a foreclosure sale. If the chattel sold has a value of $250 or more or is a branded animal, the lien claimant must file a statement of account with the county recording officer. The lien claimant must send a copy of the statement to the owner of the chattel, and if the chattel sold was a branded animal, a copy to the Department of Agriculture as well. This was an attempt. The advisory committee, throughout its considerations, wanted as much information given to all parties concerned in a lien foreclosure proceeding as possible. Now, anybody who sells a chattel at foreclosure sale does have to give the information required in Section 12. The provisions for notifying the Department of Agriculture as to the sale of branded animals resulted from their request. Apparently, they have some difficulty at livestock auction sales when someone says they obtain the cattle at a foreclosure sale and have no papers to prove that. It requires an investigation on their part, and this was an attempt to make it easier for them to determine the real ownership of branded animals. Section 14 requires a lien claimant to give notice of a foreclosure sale to persons with a security interest in the chattel who have filed a financing statement in the office of the Secretary of State or in the office of the appropriate county officer of the county in which the sale is held. The lien claimant must also notify those persons whom the certificate of title indicates have a security interest or a lien in a chattel covered by the certificate of title. With the exception of the persons indicated on a certificate of title, the secured parties or other lien holders must discharge the lien by full payment in order to preserve their security interest or a lien. And if they don't preserve their security interests that way, their security interests are extinguished, with the exception of the security interest indicated by a certificate of title. If a lien claimant fails to notify a secured party, he becomes liable to that person for a sum equal to the fair market value of the chattel sold or the amount due that person under the security agreement at the time of the foreclosure sale, whichever amount is less. Section 15 maintains a current provision of the law which prohibits the sale of more fungible chattels by a foreclosing lien claimant than is necessary, and it maintains the existing sanction for violators. That was part two concerning possessory chattel liens. Part three, as I said, deals with non-possessory chattel liens, and this part contains all the remaining chattel liens currently found in ORS Chapter 87. One exception to that is the lien for labor and materials furnished to a railroad contractor, which has been repealed. The advisory committee felt that anyone who could claim a lien under that particular provision could also claim one under the revised construction lien in 2336. So the advisory committee repealed that particular lien. 2335 maintains current law concerning the priorities of non-possessory chattel liens and security interests in chattels. A pre-existing security interest in a chattel has priority over a general non-possessory lien on that chattel. Of all the, there are a number of non-possessory chattel liens in ORS in Chapter 87. With the exception of the general non-possessory chattel lien 87-100, they have priority over pre-existing security interests. That particular scheme was maintained. Section 16 of the bill is the general non-possessory chattel lien statute. It does not have priority over pre-existing security interests. The other non-possessory chattel liens, sections 17 through 19, do. Section 21 allows the fisherman's lien and the agricultural labor liens to attach to the proceeds of the sale of the chattel subject to those liens, as well as to the chattels. This maintains current law. There is a section in the law which attaches those liens to the proceeds. And the conditions for the attachment to the proceeds are the same as under current law. Section 22 requires a person claiming a non-possessory chattel lien to file a notice of claim of lien not later than 60 days after the close of the furnishing of the labor, services, or materials for which the lien is claimed. This was an attempt to bring uniformity to an area that is now quite diverse. Section 25 allows persons to claim liens only for labor, services, or materials performed or furnished during the 6 months immediately preceding the filing of the notice of claim of lien. Section 26 allows foreclosure by suit or by the procedures provided in Section 28 to 34 of the draft. And those sections, 28 to 34, are closely patterned after the provisional process statute found in ORS Chapter 29. A lien claimant must apply to a court for a court order allowing a foreclosure sale. The lien debtor has an opportunity to appear before the court, present evidence, and challenge the allowance of a foreclosure sale. If the court orders a chattel sold, the sheriff of the appropriate county conducts the sale after advertisement in the county newspaper. The lien claimant must give notice of the foreclosure sale to the lien debtor, other lien claimants, and secured parties.
Incidentally, that provision is new and was put in by the reason of the United States Supreme Court decision so that you cannot go out and repossess a chattel. I forgot the name of the, I'm trying to think of it on the way down here. What's the name of the
those
cases? The what?
Fuentes versus Shelley. There's a later case.
So these are put in to take care of that situation of the due process before you go out and take possession of the stuff.
Section 40 allows the owner of a chattel subject to a non-possessory lien to file a surety bond, an amount not less than 150% of the amount claimed under the lien, in order to release the chattel from the claim of lien. And when he files that bond, the lien attaches to the bond and the chattel is free of the claim. Section 41 requires a lien claimant who receives full payment of his claim to file a certificate that states the claim of lien is discharged. And if he fails to do so, he's liable for the amount of $100 plus actual damages. Part 4 deals with the liens on real property. There were only four of these. No changes were made. The only substantive change, well, with the exception of the establishment of a uniform 120-day period for filing notices of claims of lien. Once again, there were various times specified in those four liens. Except for this change and some reorganization and simplification of the current sections, these four liens remain basically unchanged. Part 5, the miscellaneous provisions, sections 53 and 54 amend the agricultural produce lien to change the date on which payment is due to the agricultural producer and to allow the lien to attach to the proceeds of the sale of agricultural produce. Sections 56 to 68 revise the attorney's lien. Generally, the revised attorney's lien requires an attorney to formally file a notice that he's claiming a lien and requires foreclosure of the lien within a specific time. If the attorney claims a possessory lien on his client's papers and personal property, the client may file a surety bond in order to free the papers or property from the claim of lien and reacquire possession. That is a very brief summary of 2335. If there are any questions on the bill, I'll be...
Mr. Margoski, are you able to leave your written testimony with us?
Yes, I'll be able to provide copies to members.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, what is their 150% bond for the value of capital?
Well, it was felt that 100% would not be sufficient in order to pay for recording costs, filing fees, or perhaps the attorney's fee for foreclosure proceeding to foreclose that lien was necessary. So the extra 50% was to cover those collateral costs.
Are there further questions? Then do you wish to go into 2336?
Yes, I can proceed with 2336. General revision of the mechanics and material mix lien, the current ORS 87005 to 87075. And the number of changes made in here were fewer. The definitions of terms generally applicable to the bill are contained in Section 2. Three of the four definitions in the current 87005 are retained without substantial change, and those are improvement, construction, and agent of the owner. The definition of mortgagee is expanded to include a person who has a valid subsisting trust deed of record securing a loan upon a land or improvement. The existing definitions of owner and contract purchaser are combined in a new definition of owner that also includes a lessee of land or an improvement. There are six new terms: commencement of the improvement, contractor, original contractor, preparation, site, and subcontractor. Contractor is defined so as to exclude materialmen. An original contractor is defined as a contractor who has a contractual relationship with an owner. And that definition of original contractor is taken from an Oregon Supreme Court case. Now, Section 3 of the 2336 specifies those persons who can claim a lien under the bill. And it adds those persons who rent equipment used in the construction of an improvement. It allows them to claim a lien on the improvement.
You may want to comment, heretofore, a renter could not get anything unless he could show that the article that he put into the job was completely used up in that particular job.
Subsection 2 also allows persons who rent equipment for the preparation of land to claim a lien on that land. The lien of persons who rent equipment is limited by the bill to the reasonable rental value of the equipment, notwithstanding the terms of the underlying rental agreement. Subsections 5 and 6 allow architects, landscape architects, and registered engineers who prepare plans for an improvement or a parcel of land to claim liens under this bill on the improvement or land. And under the existing mechanics and materialmen's lien law, people could not claim a lien. Section 5 requires all notices that are given pursuant to the law to be in writing and either delivered in person or by registered or certified mail. Existing ORS 87025 is amended in Section 8 to clarify the priority of liens and mortgages on the same land or improvement. Subsection 1 gives a lien on land created under subsections 2 or 6 priority only over liens, mortgages, or other encumbrances which attach to the land after or are unrecorded at the time of commencement of the improvement. Subsection 2 gives a lien on improvement created under subsections 1, 4, or 5 priority over all prior liens. The distinction maintains the current distinction in the law and simply liens that are claimed for work which add to the value of the improvement get priority over all prior encumbrances. Those that do not increase the value of the improvement or the land do not. They only get priority over mortgages or encumbrances that were put on the land afterwards. Subsection 6 codifies existing case law that says the mechanics lien for material and labor furnished in the alteration and repair of the building, where the alteration and repair is commenced and made subsequent to the date of record of a duly executed and recorded mortgage, does not have priority over that mortgage. In a substantial change from existing law, ORS 87035 is amended to change the time limit within which a claim for a construction lien must be filed to either the 90th day after the cessation of providing labor or materials or the 60th day after completion of construction, whichever is earlier. Under existing law, original contractors had 60 days to file a claim, and all other persons had to file their claims within 45 days after the completion of construction. And this amended ORS 87035 erases the distinction between original contractors, laborers, materialmen, and subcontractors for this purpose. All these persons now have the same alternative periods of 60 or 90 days in which to file a claim for lien. Trustees of employee benefit plans, architects, and registered engineers, and landscape architects must file a claim for lien not later than 60 days after the completion of construction. 87035 now requires the claim for lien to include the street address of the property if known. Section 11, dealing with abandonment and completion of improvements, was substantially amended. Under the amended section, completion of construction occurs now when the improvement is substantially complete, when a completion notice is posted, or when the improvement is abandoned. Under present law, completion occurs when an improvement is substantially complete or when it's abandoned. So the Act now gives the owner the right to post a completion notice to indicate that the improvement is in fact complete. And he has to post this completion notice when all original contractors employed on the construction have substantially performed their contracts. The completion notice must also contain the street address. In subsection 5 of the section, an alternative procedure for establishing abandonment and hence completion of an improvement is provided. As under existing law, abandonment occurs when work on the improvement ceases for 60 days or more. In addition, abandonment now occurs when an abandonment notice is posted and recorded. And an owner or mortgagee can prevent abandonment by posting and recording a notice of non-abandonment within 60 days of cessation of work on the improvement. The notice of non-abandonment may be renewed every 180 days. It was felt by the advisory committee that there are certain occasions when 60 days will go by with no work being done, and yet the owners intend to finish the improvement, and so this allows them the option of posting and recording a non-abandonment notice, which is notice to the workers that work will continue and proceed at some future date. In subsection 7 of the amended ORS 87045 specifies the information that must be included in both the notices of abandonment and non-abandonment. In section 13, the duration of the construction lien is retained at 6 months. It changes the terminology of the section from credit to extended payment, and it allows extension of the duration of the lien to 2 years by providing extended payment. However, the terms of the extended payment provisions must be stated in the recorded claim for lien in order to obtain the extension. If extended credit is given, a lien, a mechanics, or a construction lien is continued in effect for 2 years from the time the claim for lien is filed. Section 14 is a new section that requires a person filing a claim for lien under ORS 87035 to deliver a notice to the owner that the claim has been filed. Heretofore, no such notice was necessary. This section is meant to ensure that all parties be kept fully informed of the lien proceedings. And subsection 2 of the section applies a sanction against a lien claimant who fails to inform an owner. One of the complaints that homeowners have under the present mechanics and materialman's lien is that they only have 7 days before a foreclosure proceeding begins before they, well, 7 days before a foreclosure proceeding begins is the first notice they have that a mechanics lien claim has been filed against their property. Under the current law, that's all the lien claimant is required to provide. Now he has to provide a notice to the owner that he is filing a claim for lien, and it gives the homeowner some notice considerably in advance of the commencement of foreclosure proceedings, hopefully, that something has gone awry with the construction project, that there are people who haven't been paid and who are filing lien claims. Subsection 1 of Section 15 has been amended to require that notice of intent to foreclose must be given 10 days rather than 7 prior to commencement of the suit. And the notice of intent to foreclose must now be sent to the mortgagee of the property subject to the lien as well as to the owner. Section 16 codifies Oregon case law on the question of when a person is entitled to jury trial in a lien foreclosure proceeding. The subsection expressly grants the parties to a suit to enforce a lien the right to a trial by jury of any issue triable of right by a jury if the lien is disallowed. Subsection 3 of the section provides a procedure whereby a party must demand a jury trial. The demand must be in writing, filed with the court prior to commencement of the trial to foreclose the lien. Subsection 4 requires the court to allow as part of the costs a reasonable amount as attorney fees to the prevailing party and not just to the lien claimant. Subsection 5 changes the priority in which the proceeds of a sale under the construction lien law are distributed. Under existing law, 3 classes of lien claimants exist: the original contractor, subcontractors, and all others. The laborers and material men get paid first, subcontractors next, and then the original contractor gets paid last if there's anything left. Under 2336, all the lien claimants are paid pro rata. Section 17 to 22 of House Bill 2336 are new sections which make provisions for land or an improvement to be released from lien claims and subsequent proceedings by the posting of a surety bond or a sum of money. And I might mention, Madam Chairman, that Senate Bill 87, as amended by this committee, is incorporated within Section 17 to 22 of House Bill 2336. They're identical. Section 24 of the bill was added by the House Judiciary Committee. It requires certain information be contained in all the building permits issued in the state. In order to claim a lien under this construction lien law, an individual requires information that's often difficult to obtain, and Section 24 was intended to remedy this problem. Certain information, the name of the builder, the name of the owner. We were told that, or the House Judiciary Committee was told that the new building permits in some counties contain very little information, and that someone who's trying to file a claim of lien is sometimes put to great effort to get this information. So now building permits under Section 24 would have to contain the information that's needed by somebody to claim a construction lien. And that's a brief summary of 2336.
We appreciate your meeting your written comments on this one, too.
Other certainly
questions?
Will.
Mr. Bartkowski or something. Thank you very much.
Before, Madam Chairman, I forgot to introduce Bob Jordan, the chairman of our Law Improvement Committee.
Thank you, sir.
He's here.
it Harold Wyatt on 2235? Hi, Wyatt.
Madam Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Harold Wyatt. I live at 1806 Camino Drive, Forest Grove. I'm president of Flavorland Foods Incorporated. I submitted a letter to each member of the committee. I'd like to briefly go through that with the committee. We are processors of frozen berries, roots, and corn, and have processing facilities in Forest Grove and Salem. And we are concerned with some of the proposed changes in House Bill number 2335, which would directly affect our operations. We were not aware of this bill at the time, or the proposed amendments at the time it's here before the House, so we have no knowledge of it, had no chance to testify. The previous gentleman who testified on behalf of the Law Improvement Committee stated that these particular amendments affecting the producers were not considered by the revision committee, so that they apparently were not a part of general improvement. 2 years ago, this section was revised and amended, and presumably gave necessary protections to the producers, and we have no knowledge of any problems that have arisen, or which in any way would affect their security, and certainly it was acceptable to everyone concerned at that time.
Just a minute, please. Mr. Hardy, are you going to address the same problem? Are you going to submit amendments?
Well, I'm not prepared to submit amendments this morning, but I can submit amendments, yes.
We are opposed to the phrase, quote, and upon the proceeds of the sale of that produce, unquote, as an addition to the present law. And that's lines 22, 23, 26, and 27 on page 24 of the bill. We contend that there is adequate security for agricultural producers under the existing law and lien procedure, which were put into effect 2 years ago in the last legislative session as a means of establishing adequate security for the producers. We have been advised by our bank, the U.S. National Bank of Oregon, who has financed our operations for the past 23 years, that this phrase, if added to the law, would basically alter the bank processor financial relationship, and our line of credit would be substantially curtailed. It is their intention to have a representative at the hearing to discuss this point with the committee, and perhaps he is here. I believe that's Mr. Pierce. We are opposed to adding the phrase, but not later than 14 days after delivery of agricultural produce to the new processor. That's items 33 and 34 on page 24. Historically, for the past 25 years.
I'm not quite sure to your references. Oh, right. All right. I'm with you. Go ahead.
That's lines 33 and 34 on page 24. That's A in those bills. Okay. Historically, we have contracted for deferred payments to producers of the products that we process. process. As a smaller processor locally owned, we'd be forced to substantially curtail our operation if the present proposal prevails. Our present capital structure would not permit us to pay for all of the produce within 14 days. Our present working relationship with producers has been beneficial for all concerned, as it has made it possible to develop new markets and new market outlets for Oregon products. Our sales volume for the past year exceeded $10 million. We are also opposed to the removal of the phrase from the existing law, quote, and receive from the agricultural producer a written demand for payment, unquote. And that's lines 3 and 4, page 25. We feel that not only would it be common courtesy to make the demand for payment in writing, but it would also save everyone concerned a lot of time and effort if the processor is asked in writing for payment. Actually, we'd be willing to assist the producer in writing this demand if this is the problem. We do not wish to be surprised by someone who may or may not have a valid claim for payment. This would cause us and our bank a lot of problems if liens are filed without our knowledge. So that pretty well summarizes our comments on this.
Mr. Wyatt, do you have any idea? You indicated that you've not heard of any abuse of the or problems with the two-year-old law. Do you have any idea where this comes from, this amendment?
I really don't know.
No, Mr. Butler just nodded. Maybe we can find out later.
Yes, I'm not familiar. I just don't know what it's all about.
I share your concern about its appearance.
You could leave your written testimony.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, sir. Doug Myers?
I think there's a copy here of my letter for each member of it.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Myers with U.S. National Bank of Oregon. I, too, am concerned with Sections 53 and 54 of House Bill 2335, which give the farmer a continuing and unidentified lien on the proceeds of the sale of agricultural goods to food processors. You've heard what the present law is. It's in my testimony. I'm not going to go through that. But this law would do away with the notice provisions, and that's what we object to as lenders. What this would mean, as a practical matter, under the provisions of Sections 53 and 54, we would be, as lenders, any lender would be uncertain of their position in relation to the food processor. And for that reason, we have to curtail our lending to them. At present time, we loan anywhere from 50 to 70% of the value of the produce to them. If Sections 53 and 54 were to become law, we have to loan a lot less than that. And only if the processor could qualify for unsecured credit would we loan as much as we have in the past. And most food processors are highly leveraged, highly loaned up, and this would just be impossible. Therefore, they'd have to cut down on what they buy from the farmer. And this means that not only would the farmer have to grow less, but he wouldn't get as much money for what he did grow. And we would like to see you delete Sections 53 and 54 from the bill.
Anybody signed up in favor?
Probably had something to do. I know this is one of Glenn Otto's favorite subjects. The Farm Bureau, I'll bet, is interested in this.
I think this would ring Senator Allen's bell.
I know there's a concern, but as a result of the bankruptcy of this food processing concern, there was some legislation passed last time, I can't remember, and I think this is probably a follow-through on that same problem where farmers haven't been paid for their produce they brought in. That's basically
this problem. Is my understanding, Senator Cook, is that one of the major food processors failed in 71 or 72 when some farmers did get stuck, so present law that sections 53 and 54 amends was then drafted 2 years ago and was passed and become law. And to my knowledge, and to people who actually know more about it in the bank than I, say there's been no problem since with the existing law. Now this amends the existing law.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Herb Hardy.
Around members of the committee, I'll try to, if you excuse me, cut short on this by what has been said so as not to hold you up. I represent the Oregon Food Processors, which includes all the major processing plants, or most of them in the state of Oregon. And it includes, and I want to make this clear at this time because there's some confusion, it also includes, we also have some co-ops which are not affected by this law by virtue of an earlier section in which in describing processors eliminated. But they do have some concern with the overall strength of the industry. Now, what happened, Senator Cook so clearly explained, was in 1971, the Hudson House and one other outfit went broke and did not pay their growers, and as a result of that, the 1973 session, and the Senate Committee on Agriculture worked with industry and with the process, food, the farmers and everybody to get a remedy that was effective. And they have a remedy that's effective. This law, as it now exists, gives a grower a lien not only upon his raw product, but upon the processed goods, so that in the event that he does not get paid, he does have a right to move against the cans of beans, corn, strawberries, or the frozen packs of whatever that may be that are still available. And I want to give you some indication that that's not a hollow right, and I'll pass around to the committee a copy of an exhibit which I introduced before the House Revenue Committee as to as to how long the inventory is held after the season. Now this example shows the 1974 pack of the 74 crop, which took place in the from May of 1974 through December. It shows that out of
as of when, when was as of when?
As of March 31st this last year. Nearly 50% of the total pack is still in the warehouse here in Oregon. Now this is larger, much larger than normal, but it is not. But it does indicate, and usually at this time of year, there's 25%. There isn't anybody who has a contract whose last date of payment isn't about this approximately this spring, and most of them come earlier, so that there's always quite a large amount of goods on hand for this purpose. There was no such law at the time of the strawberry matter with Hudson House, as Senator Cook indicated. We feel, for reasons which I will now explain, that it is important not to require payment as this bill now requires it as it in its amended form. Now let me explain something else that I'm sure the people who in good faith thought this would be helpful ignored. That is, nearly every grower of a food crop has to have money for seed, has to have fertilizer, has to have a variety of things. And those are usually financed by loans from the processor. The result is that they have worked out over a period of time a system whereby, in general, in the spring, the processor advances funds or actually advances fertilizer or other items of that nature, puts it on a credit amount, a debit amount on the books of that grower. And then they have a contract that they will pay so much for the crop, it will be paid so much within, usually within the first 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, sometimes it's 4 months afterwards, some of them run 6 months afterwards, but in any event, none that I know of that do not have adequate amount of canned and frozen food processing products left in Oregon available for the attachment of the lien. There has been nobody testify. There has been no testimony we've been able to find or hear whoever brought this bill forward that there has been any default under this lien whatsoever. And I thought the Senate did an admirable job last time in a very difficult subject not to disturb the loans and the financing of the banks to the processors, which is critical, nor to disturb the financing of the processors to the farmers for fertilizer, seed, etc., and to yet to give protection to the farmer by giving him an absolute lien on his own goods as long as they're there or upon the products that come from them. And under those circumstances, Madam Chairman, it's our suggestion that 52, 53, and 54 be left exactly as they were before they were amended by the House and by the engrossed bill. I understand that this is a long job that the Law Improvement Committee's done. It should stand, but it should stand on the basis that they put it in.
Senator Grayson.
52 or just 53 and 54?
Well, we don't object to 52, provided you restore the deleted material at the last five lines, but if that is considered, I want to point out to you the danger of not doing that.
Well, but let me ask this. Was 52 added by the House Judiciary Committee? Is that a part of the package?
I understand that is a part of the package, yes, but I can't be sure because I don't have that one with me. All I have is the engrossed bill.
Yeah.
Did you appear in the House?
No, but I would have to explain, Madam Chairman, why I did not appear in the House. When I first read this bill, there was nothing in this bill to indicate that it had any effect on the adverse effect on the processors. Then the amendment came in the House committee, and immediately the bill was engrossed, and I wasn't here. And when I found out, that's when I got back from the East yesterday.
Welcome back.
I apologize for that, but that's one of the hazards that we're running in this session, is when you do things that rapidly, and there was no opportunity, I think, to get the notice out. I don't believe that had I known about this, that they would have done what they've done here, because it's too dangerous to our economy.
But you are saying the House put this in?
Huh?
You're saying the House put this in?
Yes.
Further questions?
Now, if the committee would like, I can simply make amendments that would restore the thing the way it wants it for the benefit of the committee, if you so wish me to do them. Or I can have them for you to consider, if that may be.
Are you sure you... Look at 52 again, would you? Here on page 24. Those last four lines, I think, are the ones you're concerned about. And tell me why.
I don't object to any part of this except the deletion of the last. Why should you allow somebody who's already paid the farmer to have to thereafter pay a cost of fighting a lien? If
be anybody,
huh?
Be anybody.
Well, I mean, this is for the prepper, but this is under 80. This is it's under 87.
Yeah, it's under everybody. Well, why don't you take a look at it?
Well, the reason that thing went in there last time was because a lot of people get paid by the time, I mean, before the lien, that time is up, and it wouldn't be necessary for the person who's already paid them, then to pay the cost of it. That was all that we objected to.
Is it, Madam Chairman?
Senator.
Is it your point here that in many, many cases, the people routinely file a claim of lien even though there is no immediate, they really don't know whether the claim is going to be paid timely or not? Is that your point?
That's right.
In other words, often these builders, as you know, they just routinely do it, because if they don't, they're liable to end up short.
Yeah.
So I think this would, what you're saying is, if this language is deleted, the leanee would have to pay this fee regardless of whether...
He had paid the amount already.
During the time or not.
Yeah, but how do you get around the problem? Do you wait till the 3 minutes to 5 o'clock on the last day and hope that you haven't gotten paid?
See, this wasn't part of your problem in 1973, because you didn't stick in plus the amount of fees actually paid, and it didn't really affect it that much, but now it does. It really is not a greatly significant manner to this thing. But on the other, but I, it was never meant, I'm sure, by the drafters of the bill, if they did that, to that they were going to have this problem with the process. I think it applied to the builders and the others and the rest of the act.
Maybe what we need is some sort of provision. I don't know if this is too different to say that, let's say there's 60 days within which to file a lien, and if the lienor gives notice to them that unless it's paid within 30 days, he intends to file a lien. And then, if he if it isn't paid within 30 days, then maybe the lienor should be entitled to his costs.
I sure think so.
In other words, to get away from this all or nothing, really now, I'm sure that some contractors or subcontractors routinely go to quite an expense to file a lien on every job. Otherwise, they stand the risk of ending up with nothing. Maybe there should be a middle ground.
I think so. I would be glad to help and draft something along the line that Senator Cook has indicated, if that would be.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Good.
That concludes the hearing on 2-2335. Turn to 2336, Dean Gisvall.
I had to step out to another meeting. And I'm president of the Rental Association. And
state your name, please.
Erwin Schimmel from Power Rents, president of the Rental Association. And also with me I have Harold Wall. And we wanted to, for the record, state that we are in favor of the bill as engrossed. And if there's any questions that we can help you with, we'd be happy to. Thank you.
Emerson Hamilton.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, my name is Emerson Hamilton. I'm an electrical contractor from Eugene and represented the subcontractors association on the committee. Senator Husband indicated we worked long and hard for about 3 years on the drafting of this, and I'm satisfied, and a number of other subcontractors associations are quite satisfied with 2336 as it's now written. I can speak for the Associated Floor Covering Contractors of Oregon, the Gypsum Drywall Contractors, Independent Plumbing Contractors, the Oregon Masonry Guild, the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating and Cooling Contractors, Painting and Decorating Contractors of Oregon, the Portland Association of Plumbing, Heating and Cooling Contractors, and the Oregon Columbia Chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Oregon Civic Cascade Chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association. And all of these are quite satisfied with the updating and the simplifying of the construction lien laws that's been done in 2336, and we would urge its adoption.
Can you leave us that list?
Yes.
Senator
Carson. Carson, it might be easier to ask, are there any groups that you left out? Or is there any opposition that you know of from any of?
In the subcontractors and construction trades, I know of none.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just happen to be aware of, because it involves a client, a situation which is really rather harsh, and I don't know if that's addressed here, and I don't know what the solution is, but in this case, the client contracted to have an addition to her house done, and in good faith, she paid the contractor, who turned out to be a crook, paid him for the whole job, and now she's being sued by everybody else in sight, the laborer's pension fund, the plumber, and I don't remember who else. Now, how can really, I can understand and I'm sympathetic to the other side, but what kind of a method can we use to protect the innocent homeowner who contracts with what seems to be a legitimate contractor? And how can they possibly know about the carpenter's pension fund? How can they guard against that? We need something, it seems to me, to protect these people. Not, and don't tell me you need a contractor's licensing law. I don't think that necessarily going to
have one.
We have one that doesn't protect them.
Madam Chairman,
yes.
We did consider that problem, Mr. Senator Cook, and the question of putting up requiring every contractor to put up a bond.
Well.
And we found out that if we did that way, we'd put a lot of people out of business and add to the cost.
How about something like this? Is this impractical when supplies are over a certain amount of money are provided to a contractor for a job, that the contractor be required to send a letter to the individual to the effect that these supplies or this labor is going to be performed? In other words, I think the problem here was, there's no reason why this person should have been expected to know about the intricacies of lien law, and yet she had no idea that this contractor was running up a $1,500 bill for plumbing.
Well, let's work on that later.
I think this is the bill. I'd like
this
his
is
answer.
Bill, but this isn't the witness. Thank you, sir.
You have no response?
Well, I recognize the problem. Of course, I can see it from both sides too. I would say that from what I see, this is less of a problem than the problem of the contractor, of the subcontractor not being paid. I think that the Home Builders Registration Act that was passed in the last legislature was aimed at solving part of this problem. I think it's probably done a pretty good job, or has gone a step at least in this situation.
That concludes the hearing on 2336. We'll turn to 2232. While the members are all here, I want to tell you that we're not having a meeting tomorrow.
Whoopee.
Sorry, I missed that one yesterday.
Austin
Crowe. Madam Chairman, Austin Crowe for the Oregon State Bar. I have a handout that was prepared by the House Judiciary Committee, which I think will assist the members in looking at this particular bill. Basically, starting about 10 years ago, the Oregon Supreme Court started to cope with the problem of discerning the differences between contract and tort as far as the statute of limitations is concerned. In several cases that they decided, they made suggestions that the legislature look into the possibility of developing a uniform statute of limitations. In 1973, in the session that year, a bill was proposed which met certain objections from the state of Oregon because it attempted to establish a state of statute of limitations for the state. There were other problems concerning changing the statute of limitations concerning the Tort Claims Act. Bill 2232 is an attempt to satisfy all of the prior objections to an attempt to establish the uniform statute of limitations. And basically, I think you can see from the handout here, we've attempted to set forth basically the majority of the statutes of limitation that we're concerned with here. You'll note in the far right-hand column, I put another handwritten note in there, new, which is the engrossed House Bill 2232. I wrote in by hand what the effect of the bill as it is now would have on any of the prior statutes of limitation.
I don't think it's accurate here. This medical malpractice has changed very radically in this bill as I read it. Excuse me, go ahead.
Just a minute. I measured the air in here and I found there's 100 square feet per person, so...
I don't believe Senator Cook in maybe do you want me to go to that right now?
Well, go ahead and finish, but I just looked the bill over. It looks like the amendments were proposed by the insurance industry.
No, I think you'll find that in Section 7 the malpractice statute of limitation is exactly the same today as it was before.
Yeah, but you eliminate the opportunity. The present 12110.4 is a whole lot different than the one you got in here.
Well,
1104 says an action to recover damages for injuries to the person arising from any medical, surgical, or dental treatment, omission, or operation shall be commenced within 2 years from the date when the injury is first discovered or in the exercise of reasonable care should have been discovered. Now, that's been taken out completely.
No, it's right in Section 7, Senator. I beg to differ with you.
Section 7?
Do you have the A. engrossed House Bill 2232, Section 7, page 5?
I guess you're right.
The only change that was made, Senator, was to put in there, instead of the word medical, the word professional. And we felt that this was an amendment that was made in the House Judiciary Committee because there had been substantial hearings on the statute of limitations as it related to medical malpractice. There had been a lot of testimony concerning all sorts of professional malpractice. And the attempt originally was to make a uniform statute which would make it 2 and 10 years in the medical profession. The Oregon Medical Association came in and objected to that. And we felt that because there is a particular area of malpractice in the professional area where there is a certain period that's necessary for discovery, that we felt that a good uniform law would have one particular provision that related to all professional malpractice. So I went to great lengths to try to make the law similar to what it is at the present time. And I think, Senator, in addition to that, the bill that is presently in the House Judiciary Committee on the on medical practice, which you probably read about in the paper, initially attempted to change the statute of limitations to say 2 years from the treatment, irrespective of whenever you found out about it. And the House Judiciary Committee felt that that was inappropriate, that what we should have is basically the same statute of limitations, and the changes that they tried to make as far as the insurance questions on malpractice related to completely other areas than the statute of limitations. And I felt very strongly that we did not want to do away with the discovery period because I felt it was unconscionable. So I want to assure you that there has been no change in that, and that the House Judiciary Committee specifically put in this amendment to be sure that there is no change in the statute of limitations. Okay?
I stand corrected. Okay. But then let me see here. It looks to me
there's a mistake on the front. There's a mistake on the front of the A. Yeah. Gross bill. They use the word medical and should say professional. Now that's the summary. That's not the bill itself. You notice in the third paragraph there, it says requires action to recover damages from any act or omission constituting medical. It should say professional malpractice. Mm-hmm. And in the next to the last line, it should say constituting professional malpractice. So that takes care of that particular problem. And, I think that this helps to point out some of the difficulty. You remember in some of the cases they tried to claim that you had a contract with your doctor and that you got a longer statute of limitations because of that, and the Supreme Court said no, it's really a tort. And this is part of the problem as far as the individual members of the public are concerned that created the difficulty, and that the ordinary citizen needs to have a definitive period of time that they know of when they can sue. And this is the whole premise behind a uniform statute of limitation.
Would you address this one other point that's on this general subject that's current now in this whole discussion of medical malpractice, and tell me what it is? And that is, with the right of a minor, they're attempting now nationally, there's a big furor, and the insurance companies are claiming we don't know what's going to happen 20 years from now or something for an injury at birth and so on. How does our present law deal with that? How does this deal with that question of an injury to a minor at an early stage in order to provide the certainty for insurance purposes?
As far as the tolling provision concerning minors is concerned, that is applicable to medical malpractice action. There is no change in that, and as in any ordinary action, the statute is tolled certain statutory periods because of minority. I think that you're correct that there were attempts to try to change the statute of limitations so it would be 2 years, whether a minor or whether you're an adult and whether you find out about the malpractice or not. But this statute does not change the existing law as far as that's concerned. And I think that it probably shouldn't be changed, and at least that's my opinion. As far as the insurance industry is concerned, the only testimony that came up from the insurance industry in the House Judiciary Committee was in favor of maintaining the present 2-year statute of limitations on personal injury actions. And I should just say briefly that initially there was a proposal for the 3-year statute of limitations. And initially the proposal contained a provision which said that in any ordinary case, when you don't discover the damage, you have a period of time within which you can discover it and within which you can sue afterwards. And there was a strong feeling among most of the people who testified in the House that basically what we wanted to have was the provision that you see in the amendment here in Section 1, basically saying that you have 2 years except where there's fraud, deceit, or misleading representation. And then if you have those, then you get an additional period of time within which to sue, which basically answers the problem, because very rarely do you ever come up against a case where a person doesn't know that something's been done to them, except when you get in the area of malpractice. And that's why we have the separate subdivision to handle that question. I think basically what we have come up with is a statute which takes all the actions that you could think of that relate to injuries to person or contract and put it in a 2-year statute of limitations. There's one exception to that, and that is the Uniform Commercial Code. We felt that since that has been adopted by most of the states across the country and it has a built-in 4-year statute of limitations, that because of interstate problems that it was probably advisable to not change that, so we didn't. But basically everything else is included within a 2-year statute of limitations. We also took great pains in Section 2 and 3 to be sure that you don't run into problems of which statute of limitation is going to apply. We made it absolutely clear that the new statute takes place as of January 1, 1976, that there's no overlap there, and that it'll be made clear to the public just what statute of limitations is applicable.
Now tell me now, is this cap of 5 years on the malpractice, is that the same as the present statute, or...
Yes.
Now the 10-year cap, well, we used to have, or we have a 10-year cap on some things.
Yes, maybe I should just explain to you briefly. There's a, in Section 7 it says you have to bring it within 2 years with a maximum of 5 when you discover it. But then there's another subdivision that says if no action has been commenced within 5 years because of the doctor's or any professional's fraud, deceit, or misleading representation, then you have 2 years from the date that... fraud, deceit, or misleading representation was discovered, which is a good safety valve to have. Now, basically, the present law has a statutory limitation of or period of repose of 10 years that applies to negligence and negligent injury to person or property.
Now, is that being affected by this bill?
No. That's absolutely the same. Now, there was one change that... Excuse me.
There seems to be some conflict. It's a 2-year on personal injury. Now, is that an intentional personal injury?
That includes all personal injuries, intentional or negligent.
We've got negligent injury to person down at the 10-year point.
Yes. Well, you see, there's a statute presently, 12.115, which says negligent injury to person or property, and it says a 10-year maximum period. What we have done is made the 10-year maximum period or period of repose applicable to all causes of action in subsection 1. And the reason for that is this, Senator. Recently, there was a case in the Supreme Court decided within the last month or two which interpreted 12.115, which talked about negligent injury to person or property, to actually include cases for strict liability, because they said, obviously, the legislature intended to include the action against General Motors for damage to as a result of a defect in their car to come within the ambit of this particular statute. And they went about 25-page opinion trying to say that when the legislature talks about negligence, they really mean strict liability. And I felt that was a little bit of a contortion, although probably the intent was there at the time the statute was passed to have it have the 10-year ultimate period apply. What we did was to remove that sort of problem and say, overall, you've got this 10-year limitation, which is a period of repose.
But it says 6 on mine. Am I wrong here? On page 2, they reduced it from 10 to 6?
Well, in Section 3, you'll see in the bottom, there's the word 6. Is that what you're referring to?
And I see Section 4 on page 2, line 33.
Yes. Now, that is not one of the bar amendments. This was promoted by the Association of Contractors, I
General
believe.
Contractors.
They reduced it from 10 to 6. And I really shouldn't be speaking to that, because that's something that is not part of the bar bill, but it used to be 2 and 10, and it's been reduced to 6.
You wouldn't object if we raised it up to 10 again?
No, and as far as I'm concerned, the bar had gone along with the keeping the 10-year period, so I would have to say I'd have to be sort of in favor of that. And as I say, the 6-year period is not something that I had anything to do with. The only other changes in the bill that you'll see is that the death statute, just housekeeping measures to reduce it from 3 to 2 years, and that had to be done by virtue of the statute.
Could you tell me, are there any other changes that were put in here that were not in the bar bill originally, that were put in by various associations that have special interests?
No.
That's the only one?
Yes. The only, that's correct. The change that was made in subsection 1 was a change from what the bar had to restoring the law as it is now, and I have explained that already, but basically the only change that is in this law that was, there are two changes. One is in Section 7 on the malpractice, making it apply applicable to all professions, which is for uniformity's sake, and the one on 6, which is something that we didn't have anything to do with. Now, the gentleman who's sitting next to me pointed out the question of contracts. and I think it's on the sheet that I handed out, that the 6-year statute of limitations for contracts is reduced to 2 years. And the reason is that for the contract tort problem was the major difficulty that we were facing. And everybody who testified in the House, and I think even previously, said that, in fact, in most business transactions where you have a contract, as soon as the contract is breached, you have a lawsuit within a relatively short period of time. I have with me a compilation of the statute of limitations of the state of California, and look at the size of it. It's incredible, the size of it. But the point is that in California, the statute of limitations for contracts is 2 years, and I think the experience has been generally that you find that actions on such business transactions are done relatively quickly after there's a breach or a violation because of economic motives, and that the change in that particular regard is one which is important as far as uniformity is concerned to get rid of the contract tort dilemma that the state has been in with the decisions of the Supreme Court over the last few years.
Senator Smith.
I heard you say, and I haven't read it, with respect to malpractice, how have you broadened the language, and to whom now does malpractice extend?
Okay, here was the problem. Just briefly, in the House Judiciary Committee meetings, as you know, there was a bill introduced by the doctors. I think it's 2647 to reduce the statute of limitations. And there was a lot of concern. I think there was an article in the Oregonian which raised some grave questions as to the statute of limitations. I think they said, changing the statute of limitations from 2 years from the occurrence of alleged malpractice rather than from the date discovered would be a gift to the medical profession without compensating protection to victims of incompetence or negligence that is only belatedly discovered. And I think the members of the House felt that it would be unconscionable to change the statute of limitations from what it presently existed as. When the original bill, as it proposed, had expanded the statute of limitations, the ultimate discovery period, from 5 years to 10 years, and made all causes of action uniform, in other words, didn't distinguish between malpractice and an ordinary cause of action. The Oregon Medical Association came in and testified that to expand the statute of limitations with the problems that they were running into with insurance, and you've been reading and hearing about it, I'm sure, was very bad, and they were strongly opposed to that. The House Judiciary Committee felt that there was a legitimate basis for segregating professional malpractice because the undiscoverable type claims come up in all malpractice, whether it's an architect, a dentist, a lawyer, a doctor, whatever professional is involved, because you don't have overt damage like your car dented or your house burned or something like that. There's always a period of discovery that you need to have there. So what they felt was that they indicated to the medical profession, we think the present statute of limitations is good. We think that it should be applicable, the discovery period should be applicable to all professions, because there were some arguments before that if a doctor commits a wrong and there's a discovery period within which he can be sued, the same thing should be applicable to doctors, lawyers, and architects as a whole. So what they really did was expand the ambit of malpractice to include more than just doctors and make it a general period so that everybody would know just what it was.
Madam Chairman?
Sure, that's a good idea.
I wonder myself. What evidence is there that this should be done? That 5 years is enough time to the cap thing has always bothered me, and it reverses the common law, of course, which didn't have any cap at all.
Well, as far as the ultimate period of repose, the basic philosophy for a statute of repose is that after a certain period of years, people should know where they stand claims-wise. I'm not here to advocate for the doctors, but apparently the major problem that they're facing with their malpractice insurance is this long tail, as they call it, extending out the period of responsibility so that a doctor who retires at 65 has to keep malpractice insurance in effect until he's effectively, if the 10-year period was in there, for another 10 years till he's 75 and pay the rather substantial premiums all that time. As a lawyer advocating for the individual who is injured rather than any particular professional group, I think that you can legitimately say that you need to have a discovery period. The legislature, in all tort negligence actions, felt that 10 years was reasonable. They had, as you can see from the amendments to 12.110, amended the doctor malpractice statute in 57, 67, 69, and 71. And there were changes that were made by the legislature, which ended up with a 2- and 5-year period. And I think that as a matter of practicalities, the House Judiciary Committee felt that they were not going to go along with the doctors to reduce it anymore, but they felt that the status quo was adequate. And I think that the testimony is from most of the witnesses, and I happen to be present at all the hearings in the House on medical malpractice, was that with the exception of very few cases, most cases are found within the first couple of years, but there's always one that's going to carry it out further, and that's the one that they wanted to have the 5-year period for.
How about other kinds of malpractice? I mean, this does broaden it, and it extends this. I suppose there could be an argument in the body. It's going to be pretty hard to ascertain 5 years later whether it was a result of medical malpractice.
Fantastic proof problems, I think.
Yeah. How about in other things? Do you think that this same consideration applies to legal malpractice or architectural malpractice, which this apparently would, all malpractice this would affect, wouldn't it?
Right.
Do you think the same considerations apply?
Well, I think, and I'm not here as an advocate for the insurance industry, but I brought along with me a statement that had been made at the Bar Convention in Bend last fall, where one of the representatives of the insurance company that it does insure a lot of the lawyers was there, and he was saying that from 1962 it was $35 a year for a lawyer, and then by 1970 it was $268, and just, you probably read in the paper recently, there was a 300% increase recently, and I...
Bigger than the medical malpractice. That's an interesting thing. I think we ought to bring out. The insurance companies have increased the lawyer's malpractice by a larger percentage than they've increased the doctor.
Yeah, but theirs went from 3 to 14,000. Yours went from 200 to 500.
Well, we're dealing with property, and they're dealing with lives. I mean, I think there's a difference.
Oh, yeah.
I think that basically now, I think one of the figures that I talked to the agent specifically to find out, and he says it costs $750 per lawyer in your office for the first 300,000, and then it costs another $750 to increase the limits up to $1 million. And so you can just figure it out what it costs individually, and there's a substantial cost in there. And as
well,
I say,
I don't think that really responds to my question. I'm sure you didn't intend it shouldn't be responsive, but the time thing, how many claims... I wonder, and maybe you could find out, I'd be interested in how many malpractice claims are asserted in the period 5 years or more after the event.
I think from my personal conversations with the agent, he said that there have only been one or two in the last many years that he's been the agent where something like that has come up, but there is one or two that will come up, and the question is, do we want to have a uniform period or do we not want to have a uniform period? And I think what you have to look at is that the statistics show that in legal malpractice, 50% of the claims involve letting the statute of limitations run, for instance, and this is a harm to the public because people lose their cause of action and all lawyers aren't sure.
Senator Brown.
What about the problem of the defectively drawn will in some years past in excess of 5 before this is discovered? How's that handled? Legal malpractice cases in California, I know, for defectively drawn wills.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that obviously this would be a defense to a case like that after that period of time had expired.
Be sure you have a healthy client.
Well, do you have questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Has there been architectural malpractice, engineering malpractice before?
Yes. Basically,
it's not attacked in another way. I know that there's liability, certainly, but is there malpractice? Has there been?
Yes, and for instance, I know a professional engineer that I have used as an expert witness in cases recently sent out a form saying, you want to retain me to do some work as an expert for you. Please sign this waiver of insurance, or please agree to pay this additional part of premium for my malpractice coverage because my rates have gone up so high that before I can work for you, I have to do this.
Well, let me ask you a question this way to get at it, really. Could there be action before this bill brought for malpractice in every profession that this bill now covers?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Common law.
Right.
The roof of the Gresham Bowling Alley was blown off in 1962. I think it was in the Columbus Day storm, and I think there was a legal action malpractice brought there. architect or engineer.
This doesn't limit the causes of action for malpractice as far as any profession is concerned.
I was interested whether to put another question.
This limits it more. This restricts the rights.
I understand that. That's not what I was getting at.
Right.
Doesn't create any rights.
Did you get the question?
Yes,
thanks. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Crowe.
Thank you.
Sam Johnson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I had to join a colleague here because I'm here from the Debtor Creditor Rights Committee of the Oregon State Bar. And I don't in any event want to get into a position where our committee is opposing what has been promulgated by the bar as such. But it was our understanding that the reduction of limitations proposed by the bar originally would not affect contract actions, and that is the only area to which I'm addressing myself. I would like to note to the committee that there are only two states in the union, to my knowledge, which have such a short statute as a two-year statute in contract actions, those being Alabama and Texas. 6 years is a rather modal figure in contract actions. I think it appears more frequently than any other particular figure, and I believe you see them all over the map, everywhere up to 15 years in Puerto Rico. Our committee had actually treated this matter, but had decided not to to put a bill in, and of course the Practice and Procedure Committee did put a bill in, which generally, of course, we approve. I wouldn't be here except that it was my understanding that there had been an essential change. I've just now had the opportunity to look at the gross section, but we had, for whatever it's worth to this committee, we had concluded that the four-year statute that's found in the UCC covering apparently breaches of contract, whatever that means, would perhaps be an appropriate solution for strictly contract actions. So that's all I really have to say.
I just should respond to that and say that the Bar Convention had a continuing legal education session on statute of limitations in Bend last fall, that the specific purpose of the uniform statute of limitations is to get rid of the distinction between contract and tort. This is what was voted on by the Bar not only in 1973 but in 1974. And the statute as originally proposed by the Bar was to make contract and tort uniform. And I wanted to make that perfectly clear to you, that that was the whole purpose, the essence and the basis of it was to get rid of the distinction between contract and tort and yet not affect the uniform commercial code. And I beg to differ with my colleague here as far as that interpretation is concerned.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. McElwain.
I'm John McEwen, and I'm the hired man for something called Retail Credit Association, which is a trade association of consumer credit granting firms in the Portland area. We don't operate any business. We kind of at the fulcrum of the debtor-creditor spectrum, and we try to look at both sides of the picture. One of our principal activities is support of the Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Oregon, and that's, of course, is we think one of the most humane things that goes on in the debtor-credit relations field as far as consumers are concerned. I'm getting into what Mr. Johnson just broached, and I'm puzzled by it too. The language of the bill deals mainly with actions of a tort nature and generally in that area, but the repeal of 12080 appears to apply to virtually all commercial transactions. It would reduce the statute of limitations on such transactions from 6 to 2 years. And while this reduction has some obvious disadvantages to creditors, it also very probably has some detrimental effects on consumers. A creditor faced with invalidation of accounts in 2 years rather than 6 will almost certainly hasten his collection procedures. In anticipation of a earlier outlaw date, creditors will be most apt to place accounts with collection agencies earlier, and similarly, collection agencies in turn will be likely to intensify their efforts in order to beat the outlaw date. all of this would be expected to intensify pressure on hard-pressed debtors, particularly at this stage of the economy. The same detrimental effect would, I'm sure, appear in commercial transactions, where creditors recognizing they're relatively rapidly slipping away of the collectibility of their accounts are apt to speed their collection measures and be more reluctant to enter into an extension agreements and that sort of thing. I think it would just put a speed up on the whole collection procedure system, both in the consumer and in the commercial field. Our association is well acquainted with the aims and objectives of the Oregon Association of Credit Management, which is our parallel in the wholesale field. Those are wholesalers, jobbers, people who have the commercial credit field in their purview.
Madam Chair, may I ask him a question at this point?
I'm sorry.
I was just wondering, though, since the ordinary debt, I don't believe that this would change that. The statute runs from the date of last payment.
True, but often there is quite a lapse.
In other words, they could stave off the statute by paying you a buck, and there you go. You've got 2 more years.
This is true. The only thing is that in many cases the payment is not forthcoming, and I think there'll be other people that'll testify to that behind me, and so I won't go into that field. There are many accounts which haven't had a payment for 2 years, and
well, I mean, is another 2 years of ripening going to make it any better?
Quite often, and I think that another witness can probably more specifically add to that. Those are, in a rather lengthy experience in consumer credit, would be my very considered opinions of the results of such a change. I will have to take exception to the remark that California is on a uniform 2-year statute. My information is that the only thing that California is on 2 years is in oral agreements, and that written book accounts are 4, and contracts as well. They run Alaska, these are open accounts in years, Alaska 6, Arizona 3, California 4, Colorado 6, Idaho 4, Montana 5, New Mexico 4, Utah 4, Washington 3.
Madam Chairman, one more question.
Yeah.
Is your main concern the skip?
That would be one. That's the biggest single source of loss to consumer credit grantors.
If we could figure out an amendment that would somehow provide for the tolling of the statute where a person moves from the address he lived at, rather than having to force him to leave the state, if we could provide a method of tolling the statute if he moves from the address where he was living at the time the credit was extended?
The difficulty with that is that you don't have uniform universal registration of citizens. You don't know. You're proving absence and proving concealment.
Well, you know, if we had keyed it into the address where they lived, you certainly would have the address on your records at the time the credit transaction occurred. If one tied it somehow to that.
Well, it gets awfully vague as to whether a person, then you get into domestic situations, and it would, I think, complicate it to a point that it would be quite difficult. It seems to me that a fair cut situation in years that we have now. I don't know of any difficulty that the present statute has created. Incidentally, and I'd say parenthetically, there is already a deviation from the straight 6 years in a short 2-year statute as to women. That's that's in 108.040, and that I think is designed to avoid a hardship. And I won't go into that because I know you're busy and want to consider other bills. But the effect would be, I feel sure, would be to intensify rather than to relax. And I don't think this is a stage of the economy where we want to intensify collection effort. What the world needs is more sympathetic creditors and not more impatient ones.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Nowak.
Fine. My name is Dennis Nowak, and I work as a business manager at Emanuel Hospital in Portland, Oregon. here today more or less wearing two hats, representing the hospital industry in the area of consumer credit granting, and also as a member of the board of directors of the Portland Retail Credit Association. The way that I've interpreted some of the wording in this bill, it would come to the attention of what Mr. McEwen just was reiterating, that in the healthcare profession, it is not uncommon at all for skips or bills to be to receive non-payment for 2 years. I.e., I had a bill cross my desk Monday of this week, $17,000 incurred in 1972, and we don't know where the person is. 39 years old, both of are married, both people were working, they just up and they're gone on $17,000. Very capable people paying a bill if the intention was there. Now, it's my opinion that these are the type of people that you want to try to find and have your statute working for you to do to proceed in a collection action on them. Because the total effect on this, if you people can realize what $17,000 of a write-off does to a hospital financial statement, one person like this incurring a bill can raise the room rates for you and I going into that institution as much as $1 and $2 a day. Now, if we lower the statute on this and are forced into a write-off situation automatically in a two-year period, here goes hospital costs again. I think it's a point to ponder. This is one isolated case. We had a bill last year, 1974, at Emanuel Hospital, of a write-off of $41,000, that the person completely disappeared from the face of the earth. Now, if we can't turn this person into an organization such as Mr. McEwen's at the Portland Retail Credit Bureau to put this on his credit record and tie him in with any other financial obligations that he may have incurred, rent, car payments, whatever they may be, so that if any one of these credit lending institutions runs across him, then we've got our name in the pot also to come back on. The cost of these people beating hospital bills, and doing so, I have to say, intentionally. I have to say that from the standpoint that anybody that has the convictions and the morals to come in and talk to me about a large bill and want to make a payment program arrangement or at least let me know their circumstances and work with me is different than a person that just takes off and has no intention of paying you completely.
Questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Fuji, you wanted to be hearing that. What is it? 2335?
Yeah. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Hart Fuji with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm sorry I was late this morning. And I certainly appreciate your taking time to review the proposed amendments that we're suggesting. I turned into your clerk copies of the amendment. These are amendments that were developed in cooperation with the processors. They had some problem with the bill that was drafted and passed by the House. And on page 24, line 33 and 34, we delete the new language that was written into the bill. But not later than 14 days after delivery of the agricultural produce to the food processor. This was requested by some of our growers that the time period ought to be shortened, but the industry and many of the growers feel that this is not the time to change a long-standing practice of the industry. So this, we agreed to the deletion of the new language, page 24, 33, and 34. Then on page 25, after line 4, we would add a new sub 3, which would say this section does not apply to a cooperative association or to any pooling arrangement
in which producers or owners of agriculture commodities share in the proceeds of sale according to the participation and pooling arrangement. Now, in the definitions for this particular lien section, cooperatives are exempt from the Act, and so the first part there may or may not be necessary in reference to the payment period. Because cooperatives in Oregon, it's a general practice to pool the products of the members and the also non-members that bring produce to a cooperative, and the non-members are treated in the pool same as the members, so that as the pool is sold, then progress payments are made until the pool is closed out and a complete settlement is made. Now the second portion of this, in speaking of pooling arrangement, there are instances, particularly in the case of Bartlett pears and cherries for processing, in years when they have surpluses, rather than having these being dumped on the market, they usually form of the unsold commodity a pool of all of the, not only of the processors, but the growers, of the items in surplus, and try to sell them on an orderly arrangement. And as the progress payments are made and the final settlement is made, payment is paid out to all people involved, whether they be growers or processors that have bought, or dealers who have bought fruit from the growers, so that everyone shares equitably after the costs of storage and selling are deducted. And we felt that this is necessary, that this not be subject to any payment schedule, or because in a pooling arrangement, there may be some dates set up for progress payments, but depending on the situation, they may have to adjust these. And so we feel that they need to be exempt from the provisions of the section.
Howard, you weren't here when, I don't think you were, when the industry representing the processors that testified against each one of these provisions. And I presume you don't want to see 53 and 54 removed.
No. If I might, Madam Chairman, just briefly explain the reason why this particular lien law provision came about. Early in either 1970 and 71, a lot of farmers were caught on the bankruptcy of two.
But then we passed the new law in 73.
Yes.
How many bankruptcies or failures or farmers have been hurt since the new law came
well,
online?
Well, there haven't been any, but their farmers were caught with about close to $500,000 worth of collections that could not be made for produce delivered in 71, and this is the reason for. And our rationale was this, that a processing plant, unless the raw product comes to the door, nothing happens. And where the situation has been is the financial institution that holds the warehouse receipt, they have first call on the money. Of course, I think a labor lien might take precedence over that, but we felt because the raw product was the basis for the foundation for the entire thing, that there ought to be a prior lien on the produce as it came through the door.
That's not this bill.
No, but this is the purpose of the exercise.
Well, yeah, but you're not getting correct me, you're not going for a prior lien, you're going for a payoff.
Well, you mean on the new language on the upon the proceeds of the...
Oh, that. True, but I'm thinking, you're willing to take out that 14 days.
14 days,
right.
And then add the other one to exempt the cooperatives and the cooperative pooling arrangement.
In other words, whenever the farmer, the producer, agrees, then his lien will not attach, in effect, because co-ops are farmers.
Yes,
and
that's right.
Pooling arrangements are usually agreements with farmers and
right.
processors.
Mr. Fuji, Herb Hardy is working on amendments. If you could work with Mr. Hardy, it would be a help to the committee.
Okay.
Further questions? Meeting is adjourned.